For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, hear legendary rock guitarist Jorma Kaukonen talk about how he's been playing the music he loves for more than five decades. Film writer Chris DeShiel reflects on how the cinematic experience has changed as movies have transitioned from big screens to TV screens to the palm of your hand. And the Stairwell Session features singer, songwriter, and guitarist Cyril Barrett, one of Tucson's little-known veteran musicians. Those stories are all next, here on Arizona Spotlight. The legendary rock and roll players of the 1960s transformed music, but that revolution didn't happen out of the blue. Many of the most experimental musicians of the era grew up listening to genres like folk, gospel, and blues, and those influences would help shape the sound of the future. As teenagers growing up near Washington, D.C., Jorma Kaukonen and Jack Cassidy listened to and played a lot of music together. It was a chance to join a newly forming San Francisco band that brought them out west, and it was Jorma's suggestion that the band be called the Jefferson Airplane. But even during their 5 years as psychedelic rock pioneers, Jorma and Jack continued to explore their love for blues and American roots music in their own band called Hot Tuna. Today, that musical friendship endures, and Hot Tuna will visit the Rialto Theater in downtown Tucson next weekend. That gave interviewer Jake Feinberg a chance to talk with Jorma Kaukonen, one of the most highly regarded guitarists of his generation. Jake started by asking Jorma to tell him who he and Jack really are today.
Well, that's a good question. I think we're two old friends that listen to each other, both inside and outside the art. And one thing that I think that whether you are enamored by our music or not, you know, we're telling the truth as best we know it.
You know, I'm not a musician, but it seems to me that your generation and you specifically grew under the tutelage of mentors who expressed their leadership and their credibility in nonverbal ways. And I couldn't help but just start with a guy like the Reverend Gary Davis.
You know, in some respects, I still sit at the Reverend's feet. I'm not a Reverend specialist like some people are, like some of the great players like Ernie Hawkins or Woody Mann or Stephan Grossman. There's a bunch of people out there that understand his idiosyncratic way of playing better than I. But there was something about the Reverend that announced himself to me as my muse, and in some respects he still is. You know, I don't spend the time filleting Reverend Gary Davis songs like I used to, but his, you know, he's such a biophile. You know, his love of life. I mean, here's a blind black guy, sight impaired black guy, you know, born in the late 1800s down in North Carolina. It was not, in many respects, it was not a fun life, I'm sure. But, and I didn't know the Reverend as well. Some of the other people did, but he's always seemed to me to be such a positive person, you know, without even giving a nod to whatever sundry, you know, social and physical handicaps might have been. But, you know, one of the things, like I tell my students when I'm teaching, is most of our successes and our progress in life are defined by our inadequacies rather than our strokes of genius, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid and I was learning how to play this stuff, I couldn't do it the way the Reverend did, and I got a lot of static from the hardcore, you know, blues and, you know, blues characters, and, oh, you know, the Reverend didn't do it this way. But, you know, I just wanted to play the songs. I mean, today I would say, well, you know, the Reverend might not have done it this way, but I do, and it's worked out okay for me. I wouldn't have said that back then, but it really is true. I mean, the fact that I didn't have those insights into being able to clone some of the details, you know, I developed, and I certainly didn't think about this at the time, but I wound up developing my own style. I heard a story from somebody. I was doing that Pete Seeger's Clearwater Festival up in the Hudson River 2 years ago. And I was doing an interview with this Brit, And he had come over. He was a you know, Reverend style player himself. Really played well. And he had come over years ago, back around the time the first Hot Tuna record came out. And he, at this time, you know, he was one of the guys who looked askance at guys like me that didn't do it the right way. You know? but he knew the Reverend, and so he was at the Reverend's place, and he went down into the basement where the Reverend had a record player, and he saw that the Reverend had the first Hot Tuna record there. And he put it on, and the Reverend came downstairs, and he said, talking about my playing, "That boy can improvise."
We live in a day of total interconnection now, even though that your Fur Peace Ranch is just looks tantalizing. You bring in a lot of guys like you that didn't do it, quote unquote, the right way. Tell me about the Peter Rowan way, the Gene Clark way, the Jack, right. You know, the Jorma Kaukonen way. What is that way as opposed to the right way?
Well, I think it's focusing on your own, you know, that so-called right way, in my opinion, you know, and we always have to learn from somebody. So you start someplace knowing nothing, and you need to focus on something to need to learn it. But at some point, whether it's an accident, you know, or whether it's a confluence of your inadequacies, or whether it's a conscious decision, at some point, you know, as an artist, I think you have to realize, you know, I've gotten what I need, and now I need to do something with it. You know, I have all these colors in my palette, or whatever metaphor you want to use. What am I going to do with them now? You know, maybe you use sounds in a way that evokes some aspect. Let's say a guy like Reverend Gary Davis. I mean, you know, my version of "I'm the Light of This World," for example, which I have been very fond of for a very long time, contains some of the Reverend's cool intricacies, but that's really not the way he does it. And it's great the way he does it, and it was great the way I did it.
Now, we're talking here with Jorma Kaukonen. And, on the East Coast, can you tell me, I've interviewed a lot of guys like, Cosby was doing stand-up before anybody knew who he was. You know, Grisman was part of the jug band scene. Queskin was there. Van Ronk, I think. But I want to know where Kaukonen pre-Heliport, pre-Marin County, what was Kaukonen doing? Were you in all those scenes? Or paint the picture for me.
Well, I was. I was in the scene, but I was a complete non-entity. I mean, I was there in that era. And those black and white pictures, I remember that. You know, and all that kind of stuff. I went to the West Coast to go to school. It seemed like the right way to stay out of the draft at the time, which I wasn't interested in participating in. So I went out there to go to school. And the first week that I was there, I was going to school in Santa Clara, which is down the peninsula from 50 miles south of San Francisco. I'm walking around, and there's a poster, a billboard, you know, just a mimeograph poster on a telephone pole that said, "Hootenanny, Folk Theater, First Avenue, San Jose." And so I went, and that night I met Jerry Garcia, Janis Joplin, Ron McKernan, who we know as Pigpen today, mm-hmm. and a bunch of the regulars, you know, that became, you know, a name recognizable over the years. And that's just how the scene was, you know. And I played my music, and they liked it, and I got to play behind Janis a little bit and do my own thing. And it was a very sociable, likable scene where everybody was encouraged to be good, kind of unlike the New York scene in a lot of ways, where the older guys really looked askance, you know, at some of the younger guys coming up.
Heard the violin there, Papa John Creech.
Yep, you can't miss it.
How was he a logical fit for the tuna?
Well, Marty and Joey Covington ran into him in the bar in L.A. I think it was called the Paris Club, and they brought him to San Francisco. They were playing Winterland, and he sat in and never left. I mean, he was one of these guys that obviously was coming from a much different place, but to him it was all music, and if he liked it, he was ready to play it. Really an amazing man.
That was Jake Feinberg talking with Jorma Kaukonen. Yorma will be taking the stage at the Rialto Theater on Saturday, January 25th, playing with Jack Cassidy in Hot Tuna. The show also features Leon Russell, and there's a link for more information on the Arizona Spotlight page at news.azpm.org. If today's mix of competing DVD formats and diverse video apps seems complex, think for a moment about the earliest days of movie making. The 40 years of film that preceded the advent of sound were full of ideas about the new medium's potential, and many different kinds of presentations were tried in the endless effort to attract an audience. In some ways, it's not too different from the most recent cinematic trends, like 3D, high def, and 48 frames per second. Here's film writer Chris DeShiel.
On a plane recently, I saw a child across the aisle watching a Disney movie on an iPad. And it occurred to me that film exhibition had come full circle after a century, one of the most ironic developments in the history of any art form. Thomas Edison, whose employee W.K. Dixon invented the first functional motion picture camera, completely misread the possibilities for film. He believed that the future lay in a box-like machine that individual customers would put a coin in to watch a 40 to 50-foot loop of film. The machine was named the kinetoscope, and the films shown in them were little half-minute long views of people dancing, boxing, juggling, or some other amusing activity. You may have seen such machines, or later reproductions of them, in historical museums and parks or other places catering to tourists. Well, starting in 1894, kinetoscope parlors sprang up across the country, with the Edison Company producing hundreds of short films per year to supply them. We've become so used to the barrage of moving imagery in our lives that it's hard to imagine how amazing film was at first. Film scholars often call the first 10 years or so of the movies the novelty era, because a film of almost anything could make money due to the sheer novelty of the medium. So it's understandable that Edison thought that way too, and underestimated the potential of film projection. It's not certain who first projected a film onto a screen. The Lumière brothers in France have usually been credited with doing that in 1895, but there's evidence of earlier examples in America. In any case, projection on a large screen in front of an audience soon supplanted the kinetoscope as the way to watch movies. And it's easy in hindsight to understand why. The bigger image produced a sense of awe and spectacle that was impossible to get from looking into a box. Also, sharing the experience with an audience magnified the impression. Watching something together with others turned out to be much more satisfying than seeing it alone. And it opened the way for longer and longer films. Obviously, you can endure watching something in a theater longer than you can stand peeking into a little device. The longer form led eventually to the story film, and thus to the development of commercial cinema as we know it. About 50 years later, television became the first serious threat to this model. Now you can be visually entertained in the comfort of your home. The Hollywood studios, already panicked after losing an antitrust suit at the Supreme Court, fought back with widescreen formats. CinemaScope, Panavision, VistaVision, the list goes on. Why watch black and white shows on a little box at home when you could be overwhelmed with Ben-Hur or Lawrence of Arabia on a screen half a city block long? That strategy did help, but the smart studios invested in TV production themselves, while those who couldn't adjust, like MGM, died off. Eventually, color came to TV, and of course, larger and larger screens. Yet there was, and to a lesser degree still is, a general difference in quality between television and movies. Now, there was very little curiosity about film history prior to the 50s. Once a film had run its course, it was rarely shown again. The cinephiles who started writing about older films had to rely on revivals, and eventually little theaters were founded that specialized in these movies. Buster Keaton, for instance, had almost been forgotten until his films started to be shown again in art houses. Still, it was a daunting task. Sure, there were some older films shown on TV, broken up by commercials and often butchered by editors, but most of the time you had to hope for revival showings if you wanted to see an old movie. That all changed in the mid-70s, with the creation of videos, which of course later gave way to DVDs. Now, for the first time, movie lovers could watch films from all eras, uncut, at home, when they wanted to, and they could study them closely by pausing, rewinding, and so forth. It's impossible to exaggerate how lucky we are in this respect. I myself have seen thousands of films from the silent era onward that I would never have had the opportunity to see without the home video revolution. And with the recent advent of streaming video, the process has become even less encumbered. In particular, access to non-Hollywood films from all over the world and all periods of time has increased exponentially because of YouTube and other such internet sites. As with any great change, though, there has been loss. I still prefer to see a film in a theater if possible, and there are quite a few films that you really can't appreciate fully unless you see them on a big screen. I also love the experience of seeing a film, especially if it's a good one, with an audience. But with a noticeable decline in etiquette, a pet peeve of mine is that some moviegoers today don't seem to get that a theater is not their living room. The attractions of going out have been somewhat lessened. Thus, we return full circle to the kid on the plane, watching a movie on an iPad. 120 years later, Thomas Edison's original idea, in a much friendlier and sophisticated form, seems to have finally caught on. For Arizona Spotlight, this is Chris DeShiel.
Cyril Barrett is a quiet guy, one who prefers to let his songs and guitar tell his stories. He was first inspired to play by the troubadours he heard while growing up in Idaho. He was impressed by the way they knew so many popular songs. But when he tried it for himself, Cyril was disappointed to find that learning other people's songs didn't come so easily. So he decided it was better to write his own. We'll find out more next in this Stairwell Session with Cyril Barrett. What kind of themes do you think you find yourself returning to in your songs?
Well, when I first started, I was in Seattle in this neighborhood called Belltown and surrounded with actors and writers and painters, and just it was all about art, and that's how everybody approached it, and music was like that. It was like more, I guess, like storytelling. Not necessarily always any kind of literal story. There are some of those too, but more stream of consciousness almost. I don't usually write about what in my life per se or my feelings or emotions. It's more of one step removed. So yeah, a lot of my experiences are in there too, but then a lot of it is sort of made up.
The kind of songs you're playing now in the repertoire that you have, the stuff you've got saved in your head, are there some old songs in there, ones that go back years for you?
Well, I still play some of the older songs, yeah, but most of the songs today were all within the past year, couple years.
You mentioned that you had notes in your notebook written to yourself, and things about don't play too fast, don't rush it, and stuff like that. I think that's interesting.
Well, I have actually done quite a bit of recording, and I would always, before going to the studio, I would always make pretty concise notes. So just to kind of expedite the whole recording process, in that it's so expensive that it's saved us time, I think, by having those notes. And today I was thinking about, this is a recording. It's the Stairwell Sessions. It's loose. It's live, but it's still a recording. It's like one take. So, and I think there's only one or two of them that were actually one take. There's a couple of them I did a few times, but maybe we'll pick the good one.
Walter John is bleeding where he got punched in the nose. The other kids are laughing when they threw away his clothes.
Do you play solo mostly these days?
I have been. Well, I was in a band here called The Possibles for about 3 years. And we played around quite a bit. It was with Brian Green on bass, and Lila Lopez was playing drums, and my friend Tom Moore was playing the other guitar. Yeah, over that period, I think we had, before Leela started playing with us, there was about six other drummers before that. More recently, the past 6 months or so, I've played mostly solo and also with Tua Lund. He plays the cello. Tua and I've played at Café Passé, basically played shows at Plush. I haven't played at Congress in a while. All the just local spots. I do a weekly show at the Tucson CSA. Tura and I play there every week.
What's the CSA?
Community Supported Agriculture. You join the CSA and then once a week go pick up your vegetables. And we play for a share of vegetables. That's our pay. We're volunteers, basically. It's all volunteer. It's really fun, and it's just like this, just like tonight. It was just not quite busking, but
yeah,
we got
but
invited.
You're putting food on the table, which is a
right
traditional thing
we'll
with
play
music.
For food, right?
Here we are. Well, tell us a little more about your approach to songwriting. How does it come to you? Words or music first?
It always varies, but I'm pretty connected to the guitar or the piano and then write words to it. And then the melody would already be on it, you know.
Are you good at remembering the things that you come up with?
Quite often. If I don't do anything with them, I'll just won't play them, you know, like play something for a week or something like that and then sort of doesn't take. Probably forgot at least as many songs as I've actually written.
Do you still remember the first song you made up?
Well, I vaguely remember the song. The lyrics might be in a box somewhere, but it was about a girl.
As most rock and roll is.
She brought the poet out in me.
So you had your notebook with you today, but it made me wonder if you had a shelf or a box of notebooks at home.
Yeah, there's a handful of those.
Do you ever go back and, you know, look at stuff you were doing 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
Occasionally, yeah. Get the old box out and look through it. So I'll write verses and just write, even describe things that happened in a kind of a lyrical way. And not really songs, just words. And keep all of that, and it's not any kind of real emotional attachment as much as that how much I love words and how they go together and what you can say and how, and there's no real rules.
Story unfold on a dogged, worn-out map. The creases unfold without the town where you are at. But it doesn't matter, I know the roads and all the places. The time you came here and we lost you in the trash. Alive, they say you've got to be on your toes. And hard as you hold on, you just don't have that much to show. You come in naked and you leave without your. Thank you. thought about you many times more. Look in your eye through an open door. Wish upon a wish, there is nothing that's for sure. Oh, you and I, we were always keeping score. Look alive, they say you've got to be on your toes. Oh, hard as you hold on, you just don't have that much to show. You come in naked and you leave without awfully low. You hit your head sometimes, you don't even know. The windows are dirty and I cannot see outside. So many times I wish that I could be outside.
That was called Trip to Merced, written and performed by Cyril Barrett, and performed under the stairs. The music was recorded and mixed by Jim Blackwood, with assistance from Jameson Waddell. You can find the whole session on the Arizona Spotlight page at news.azpm.org. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show originates from the AZPM radio studios. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. The music is by Calexico. I'm producer and host, Mark McLemore.